The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payton for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Associated Press. Our first article was published on January 3 and written by Bill Barrow. It's entitled, Jimmy the Baptist, Carter Redefined Evangelical from Campaigns to Race and Women's Rights, Plains, Georgia. Before reaching the 1978 peace deal between Egypt's Anwar Sadat and Israel's Menachem Begin, Jimmy Carter managed months of intense preparation, high-stakes negotiations at Camp David, and a field trip to the Gettysburg battlefield to demonstrate the consequences of war. But looking back on his most celebrated foreign policy achievement, the 39th president said intricate diplomacy ultimately wasn't the deciding factor. We finally got an agreement because we all shared faith in the same God, Carter told biographer Jonathan Alter, as he traced his Christianity, Begin's Judaism and Sadat's Islam to their common ancestor in each religion's sacred text. We all considered ourselves the sons of Abraham. Carter, who died on December 29 at 100, was widely known as a man of faith, especially after his long post-presidency became defined by images of the Baptist Sunday school teacher building homes for low-income people and fighting diseases across the developing world. Yet, beyond piety and service, the Georgia Democrat stood out from his earliest days on the national stage with unusually prolific, nuanced explanations of his beliefs. Carter quoted Jesus and famous theologians and connected it all to his policy pursuits, living out his definition of what it means to be a self-professed Christian in American politics. Most people go to Washington in search of their own power, said David Gergen, a White House advisor to four presidents. Carter went to Washington in search of our national soul. That doesn't mean those others didn't have good intentions, but for Jimmy Carter, it just seemed like a different purpose. What happened when Carter described his faith to Playboy magazine? As a candidate in 1976, Carter described himself as a born-again Christian. Based on the New Testament, the reference is routine for many Protestants in the South who believe following Jesus means adopting a new version of oneself. To national media and voters unfamiliar with evangelical lexicon, it made Carter a curiosity. We saw ourselves as being very much cultural outcasts as evangelicals in the mid-1970s, said Dartmouth College professor Randall Balmer, who has written extensively on Carter's faith. The evangelical movement had not yet become a political force mostly aligned with Republicans, and to have someone use our language to describe himself and still be taken seriously as a presidential candidate, Balmer said, was startling, really. Carter used the presidency to elevate human rights in U.S. foreign policy, champion environmental conservation, and resist military conflict. He criticized American greed and consumerism. He proselytized to other world leaders. Carter continued the approach for decades thereafter through the Carter Center and its global efforts on peace, democracy, and public health. Into his 90s, Carter criticized American militarism and noted one of Jesus's biblical monikers, Prince of Peace. He carried his faith with him every minute of every day, and he put it to use every single minute of every single day, said Jill Stuckey, a Plains resident and longtime friend of Carter and his wife, Rosalind, who died in November 2023 at 96. Carter's faith insisted on public service above politics. U.S. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg attended some of Carter's church lessons in Plains, Georgia, and sought the former president's counsel during his own campaign in 2020. He said Carter elevated faith beyond partisan divisions. There are a lot of conservatives who seem to use the Bible almost as a weapon or a cudgel. And there are a lot of liberals who seem to use faith mostly as a way to desperately signal that they're not bad people, he told the Associated Press. President Carter demonstrated a third thing, faith that calls you to make yourself useful to others. Carter's unabashed evangelism was an outlier in a Democratic Party that grew more secular and pluralistic during his public life. Yet Carter advocated absolute and total separation of church and state and opposed public money for religious schools. He admired the Reverend Billy Graham personally, but called it inappropriate to invite the nation's leading evangelical to lead White House prayer, as Graham did for previous administrations. Carter further distinguished himself from many evangelicals by criticizing Israel's treatment of Palestinians and taking liberal stances on race relations, women's rights, and, as he grew older, LGBTQ rights. He once described feeling shocked when a high official in the Southern Baptist Convention told him in the Oval Office that, "We are praying, Mr. President, that you will abandon your secular humanism as your religion." By his later years, Carter was happy with the label of progressive evangelical, Balmer said. How did Carter come to define his faith? Carter grew up as the son of a deacon in the Southern Baptist Convention, a conservative denomination founded before the Civil War as a regional splinter group that supported slavery. He did not openly question his father's segregationist views or the white supremacist origins of his denomination, and he didn't yet consider himself an evangelical as a young man. But he had exposure to black evangelical traditions by occasionally visiting St. Mark AME Church, the congregation of the tenant farming families that worked his father's land. "I could see spirit, sincerity, and fervor in their worship services that we lacked in our church in Plains," Carter once wrote. Decades later, during the Civil Rights Movement, Carter urged his Plains congregation to allow integrated worship. But he and Rosalind stood virtually alone. Carter was a state senator by then and, notably, did not offer such explicit integration advocacy beyond church walls. After his failed bid for governor in 1966, Carter was disillusioned with politics and life in general, he wrote. His sister Ruth, a well-known evangelist and faith healer, persuaded him to go on pioneer missions. The future president knocked on doors to share the gospel in Pennsylvania and in Spanish-speaking neighborhoods of Massachusetts. He came to see these sojourns as a catalyst to apply my Christian faith much more regularly to my secular life. Carter spread his gospel to folk singers and communist leaders. Carter even got to share his Christianity with Bob Dylan in a one-on-one session the iconic folk singer sought with the Georgia governor in 1971. In 1977, during his first foreign trip as president, Carter was invited by Edward Gierek, Poland's top leader under Moscow's Soviet control, to speak without their aides present, Carter later recalled. Gierek was somewhat ill at ease while explaining that he was an atheist in conformity with the Kremlin, but wanted to learn about Christianity. So Carter shared some Christian principles and asked him if he would consider accepting Jesus Christ as his personal savior. Gierek replied that he could not make a public declaration, and "I never knew what his decision was," Carter later wrote. But in 1979, Gierek rebuffed Moscow's orders by allowing newly elected Pope John Paul II to visit his native Poland. The Kremlin deposed Gierek in 1980, but that visit became a seminal moment in John Paul's papacy, and his efforts to break the Soviet Union. At a White House dinner, Carter pressed Chinese leader Deng Xiaoping to allow freedom of worship and Bible ownership and admit American missionaries. Xiaoping allowed the first two, but not the latter. Carter, in 2018, noted projections that China, by 2025, will have more Protestants than America. And at Camp David, Carter prayed often and talked openly of faith with Begin and Sadat, unpacking ancient animosities between their religions. Carter evolved on equal rights and gay marriage. When the Carters left the White House in 1981, having had enough of the lingering racial tensions at Plains Baptist Church, they transferred to nearby Marantha Baptist Church, Ballmer said. Carter's hometown funeral will take place there after his state service at Washington's National Cathedral. Carter disaffiliated from Southern Baptist 2 decades later, at the age of 76, because the denomination's leadership, he said, demeaned women as subservient to men in the home, church, and wider society. Carter remained at Marantha, noting that the congregation's deacons were divided about equally between the sexes. There is one incontrovertible fact concerning the relationship between Jesus Christ and women, Carter explained in his final book, Faith, published in 2018. He treated them as equal to men, which was dramatically different from the prevailing custom of the times. Carter had a slower shift on LGBTQ matters. In a 1976 campaign interview with Playboy magazine, he said he considered sexual relations outside of marriage as a sin and thus could not easily reconcile homosexuality. The answer did not contemplate same-sex marriage as a legitimate civil or religious institution. Carter asked, "What would Jesus do?" At his 75th wedding anniversary, as his 75th wedding anniversary approached in 2021, however, Carter had a different view on government and church-sanctioned marriage for same-sex couples. "I don't have any opposition to it," he told AP, declaring himself very liberal on an issue that relates to human rights. "Sexuality will continue to be divisive within Christianity," he predicted. "But the church is evolving." Buttigieg, an Episcopalian whose same-sex marriage is criticized by the church, said Carter's willingness to be open about his faith, in all its complexity, provides a tremendous example for a generation of Christians who don't believe that God belongs to any political party. The Reverend Bernice King, the daughter of slain civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr., praised Carter as a man of peace and compassion, and argued that for all his books and expositions and Sunday school lessons, the Baptist from Plains hewed to a simple faith. He looked at the life of Jesus Christ and how Christ interfaced and interacted with people, King said. He wrestled with that as a leader. I think he took serious, what would Jesus do? What would somebody that is love-centered do? Our next article, also from the AP, is a more personal one about Carter, and it was published on January the 3rd and written by Paul Newberry, who is an Atlanta-based columnist for the AP, who traveled to Plains, Georgia with his family and friends about 20 times to attend Carter's Sunday school. He was there for Carter's final lesson. Sunday school class with Jimmy Carter. What it was like. Plains, Georgia. It never got old. No matter how many times one crammed into the modest sanctuary at Marantha Baptist Church, there was always some wisdom to be gleaned from the measured, Bible-inspired words of Jimmy Carter. There was another side of the 39th president, a down-to-earth man of steadfast faith who somehow found time to teach Sunday school classes, when he wasn't building homes for the needy, or advocating for fair elections, or helping eradicate awful diseases. For young and old, straight and gay, believers and non-believers, black and white and brown, Marantha was a far off the beaten path destination in southwest Georgia, where Carter, well into his 90s, stayed connected with his fellow citizens of the world. Anyone willing to make the trek to his hometown of Plains, with its one blinking caution light and residents numbering only in the hundreds, was rewarded with access to a white-haired man who once occupied the highest office in the land. Carter taught his Sunday school class roughly twice a month to accommodate crowds that sometimes swelled to more than 500. On the other Sundays, no more than a couple dozen regulars and a handful of visitors usually attended services. Here, the former commander-in-chief and the one-time First Lady, his wife of more than seven decades, were simply Mr. Jimmy and Ms. Rosalyn. And when it came to worshiping with them, all were welcome. Sundays with Mr. Jimmy. Before the former president entered the sanctuary, with a bomb-sniffing dog outside and Secret Service agents scattered around, a strict set of rules would be laid out by Ms. Jan Williams, a longtime church member and friend of the Carters. She would have made quite a drill sergeant. It felt like a good cop, bad cop situation. Ms. Jan barking out rules you knew had come straight from Mr. Jimmy, who studied nuclear physics and approached all things with an engineer's orderly mind. Most important for those wanting a photo with the Carters, and nearly everyone did, you had to stay for the main 11 a.m. church service. Picture-taking began around noon. If you left the church grounds before that, there was no coming back. If you stayed, you followed rules. No autographs, no handshakes, no attempts at conversation beyond a brief good morning or thank you. Carter, consistently in sports jacket, slacks, and bolo tie, would start his lesson by moving around the sanctuary, asking with a straight face if there were any visitors. That always got a laugh. And where they were from. In my many trips to Marantha, I'm sure I heard all 50 states, not to mention an array of far-flung countries. If anyone answered Washington, D.C., the answer was predictable. I used to live there, the one-term president would say, breaking into that toothy grin. Carter's Bible lessons focused on central themes. God gives life, loves unconditionally, and provides the freedom to live a completely successful life. But the lesson usually began with an anecdote about what he'd been up to or his perspective on world affairs. Carter could talk about building homes with Habitat for Humanity or bemoan U.S. conflicts since World War II. He could talk about his work with the elders, a group of former world leaders, or a trip out west to go trout fishing with Ted Turner. He could talk about the Carter Center's success in eliminating the guinea worm, or his long-term friendships with Willie Nelson and Bob Dylan. Willie Nelson is an old friend. He used to come to visit me in the White House, Carter related once, touching ever so gently on Nelson's affection for weed. I don't know what Willie and my children did after I went to bed. I've heard rumors, the former president said with a sly grin and a wink that suggested he believed every word. My favorite? Carter telling of his latest book project and how he long used encyclopedias for research. Carter decided the collection was taking up too much space, so he boxed it up and headed out to the local schools and libraries, figuring someone would eagerly take a donation from an ex-president. Instead, he got a standard refrain. Sorry, no one uses encyclopedias anymore. I recall the punchline. How do I look up things now? Asked the man, born 5 years after World War I ended. Pause, then Google. During most of my visits to Marantha, Carter spoke for 45 minutes without sitting down. His mind remained sharp, with only an occasional glance at the notes tucked inside his Bible. But his body became more and more feeble as he moved deeper into his 90s. He talked openly about the ravages of aging. He resisted church members' pleadings to take a seat while teaching. I was there the first time he tried it, in August 2018. I'm uncomfortable sitting down, he said, but I guess I'll get used to it. Not that time. Carter sat for less than 10 minutes before rising. He stood at the table for the rest of class. Returning the following year, Carter had relented to using a white, remote-controlled chair. After climbing aboard, voila, a flick of a switch would slowly lift him above the lectern, visible even to those sitting in the back. If there wasn't enough room in the sanctuary, rows of folding chairs were set up in the fellowship hall, and a handful of tiny classrooms. Carter's lesson would be shown on TVs linked to a feed from the main room. A letdown for visitors? Perhaps, but relegation to a back room had its benefits. Carter, who usually arrived about 15 minutes before the start of his 10 a.m. lesson, would swing by these rooms before heading to the sanctuary. He would even take a few questions, which didn't happen in front of the big crowd. After a 2018 profile by the Washington Post told of the Carters having regular Saturday night dinners at friend Jill Stuckey's house, which included one glass each of bargain brand Chardonnay, I asked Carter how many glasses of wine he'd had the night before. "I'll say one," Carter replied with a sly grin. Stuckey, standing behind him, shook her head and held up two fingers. No matter where you sat, main sanctuary or back room, everyone got their picture taken with Mr. Jimmy and Ms. Rosalind. For many, this seemed the biggest reward. When we first started attending, those pictures were taken under a tree just outside the church. After being diagnosed with cancer in 2015, Carter and his wife would pose with visitors inside the sanctuary. Carter liked to joke about what a burden it was to sit for all those pictures, which surely numbered in the hundreds of thousands. "I'll be delighted to have photographs made with all of you," he quipped after one of his final lessons. "Actually, since I'm in church, I'd better say I'll be willing to have photographs made with all of you." For my family, those pictures show a son growing from boy to man with Mr. Jimmy and Ms. Rosalind, filling out their frames. What a treasure they are now. The final lesson. Turnout for Carter's Sunday school lessons dipped during the Great Recession, but the crowds returned after his cancer announcement, with some folks lining up outside the church the night before. Carter declared himself cancer-free, but other health challenges began to catch up with him. After an October 2019 fall at his home left him with a slightly fractured pelvis, the church announced Carter would not teach his next class on November 3rd, a lesson we had planned to attend. Disappointed, we canceled our hotel reservation. But Mr. Jimmy wasn't done just yet. The church had canceled without checking with him. He made it clear that he was not canceling. We quickly rebooked. Carter's lesson that day, based on the book of Job, was especially poignant in retrospect. "I'm going to start by asking you a very profound question," he said. "How many of you believe in life after death?" Carter conceded to having doubts for most of his life, right up to being stricken by cancer, which finally erased any skepticism. When the end to this world came, he would be ready. "We don't have anything to dread after death," Carter said with a reassuring smile. At the end of his lesson, he challenged everyone to do one good deed for a stranger. "I'm going to hold you to it," Carter promised. He never got the chance. His health continued to decline, sidelining him through the Christmas season. Then the COVID-19 pandemic shut down the world in 2020. By that summer, it was clear that Mr. Jimmy's treasured role as spreader of the gospel, which he began at 18 and resumed after his presidency, was over. Now a piece published on January 6th, written by Nicole Winfield, and entitled, Pope Francis Has Named the First Woman to Head a Major Vatican Office. Rome. Pope Francis, on January 6th, named the first woman to head a major Vatican office, appointing an Italian nun, Sister Simona Brambilla, to become prefect of the department responsible for all the Catholic Church's religious orders. The appointment makes a major step in Francis' aim to give women more leadership roles in governing the Church. While women have been named to number two spots in some Vatican offices, never before has a woman been named prefect of a dicastery or congregation of the Holy See Curia, the central governing organ of the Catholic Church. The historic nature of Brambilla's appointment was confirmed by Vatican media, which headlined its report, Sister Simona Brambilla is the first woman prefect in the Vatican. The office is one of the most important in the Vatican. Known officially as the Dicastery for the Institutes of Consecrated Life and Societies of Apostolic Life, it is responsible for every religious order, from the Jesuits and Franciscans to smaller new movements. In an indication of the novelty of the appointment and the theological implications involved, Francis simultaneously named, as a co-leader or pro-prefect, a cardinal, Angel Fernandez Artime, a Salesian. But the appointment, announced in the Vatican Daily Bulletin, lists Brambilla first as prefect and Fernandez second as her co-leader, which theologically is necessary, since the prefect must be able to celebrate Mass and perform other sacramental functions that currently can be done only by men. Brambilla, 59, is a member of the Consolata Missionaries Religious Order and had served as the number two in the Religious Orders Department since last year. She takes over from the retiring cardinal, Joao Braz de Aviz, 77. We have run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. Please listen again next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mary Grace Payton, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.